Before we begin, we'd like to ask a favor. If you could take a moment to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we'd really appreciate it. We're told it helps the show find new listeners. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the BLB podcast. This is the 12th episode in a series where we talk about the short story form, the writing process, and how to get published. The BLB podcast is a new project from Brick Lane Bookshop. I'm Kate Ellis, and this is my co-host, Peter J. Coles.
Hello.
For each episode, we invite a writer to read from and discuss their work. Today, we are very excited to be talking to none other than Irenison Okoje, MBE, about her collection, Nudibranch. We're recording on Zoom, so please excuse the odd wobble in our audio.
Irenison Okoje, MBE, is a Nigerian-British writer working in London. Her first novel, Butterfly Fish, won a Betty Trask Award in 2016, and her story, Grace Jones, won the 2020 Kane Prize for African Writing. She was elected as a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature in 2018. Her newest collection, Nudibranch, was published by Dialogue Books in 2019 and was longlisted for the 2020 Jalak Prize.
And now here's Irenison Okoje reading from her story, Mangata.
The man who brought a miracle to the small town in northern Mozambique was both remarkable and ordinary. As an albino, he wasn't an unfamiliar sight, although other things indicated he was different. He walked with a certain comfort in his skin that wasn't of the surroundings, assured, confident. He had a birthmark on his neck, which looked like a stem growing from his movements. His nails were painted black, his hands elegant, the fingers long, tapered. His tongue sported a silver ring at the tip, a pink pierced entity darting out readily to abandon his mouth. On the afternoon Terry Madass arrived, it was scorching. He stood waiting at the pickup point near the market, a black god painted alabaster, holding his light travel bag. His batik shirt had sweat patches, tan trousers stuck to his clammy thighs uncomfortably. The dust-covered leather sandals he wore felt heavy, he having walked a few miles in the bush to get to this point. He'd done so with trepidation, fear scattering wildfire into his veins as it spread through his limbs. He knew the stories of albinos being persecuted, hunted for the value of their body parts, kidnapped, killed, and sold. During the walk, in his mind's eye, he'd seen flashes of cutlasses raised up, bones on the necks of men whispering in the voices of ancestors, the cries of medicine men splintered in his ears. He'd seen blood in the sky and the trees shedding pale skin. He'd arrived at the market gratefully, spat from the torturous bush, out of breath. 10 years away, and nothing had prepared him for the intensity of being back. The heat, the dusty roads, the shanty houses made quaint by the distance of separation, the slick black bodies rhapsodic in their freedom. He hadn't been primed for the warmth, small bursts of joy, the fear, the feeling of familiarity, the feeling of being foreign, a mouthful of echoes slipping teasingly out of reach. Sweating profusely, he stood, walked to a shaded corner of the shop he decided to wait at, thinking of albinos that had appeared to him through night traffic. Hundreds of them, each holding angles of light, doubling as rabbit holes. It came to him then, the memory of that night years ago, the thick suffocating heat, sluggish grasshoppers chorusing, mosquitoes hovering around the one stubby shrinking candle in their shack, as if drawn to a possible death. Mama Carlos sat snoozing gently by the door to protect him in a ritual that saw her bloodshot eyes close reluctantly, eventually succumbing to the demands of the body, her large bosom rising steadily up and down, the small picture of Christ pinned on the wall above the green mosquito net, which swooped down, tiny winged fireflies with far too much gumption zigzagging above their heads, and Christ's robes singed from the blue candle flame that thought it could fly, bending willfully in the heat, his eyes temporarily blinded by tiny bloodshot figures taking residence there. Terry on the bed, tossing and turning, the sound of water in the empty petrol can on the floor by his pillow of bunched clothes. Then three men kicked down their door. He saw the glint of blades at Mama Carlos's throat, heard rough, urgent orders being issued. Mama Carlos screaming so loudly, their response was a backhand slap to her face. Terry shrank back against the wall, powerless, pale and trembling. Necklaces of small bones on the men's necks jangled, their faces partially obscured by handkerchiefs tied over their mouths. The smell of the day's sweat from their bodies mingled with fear in the room was potent. They dragged him to the rusted white truck outside, dumped him in the back, then piled in laughing, the truck screeching away, exhaust pipe smoke curling around the edges of an abduction. They sped off. The truck eventually wound its way around the bush. It was at this point Terry leapt out, running for his life. He ran so fast blindly, an alabaster boy slipped from the world's pocket into the night's cruel playground. He ignored the scratches of wild plants on his legs, the stinging on his arms. The men had left the truck, whistling crudely, clicking their fingers to catch him again. A path snaked through the bush, appearing from nowhere, glimmering, rising, rushing, similar to the noise made in their petrol can at home. He ran along the path. He never remembered how he got all the way back to the village. He'd cried in relief at the people gathered, holding kerosene lamps, babbling at them frantically, half out of his mind and skin, and everything being in the wrong place. Their shack uprooted from Mama Carlos's injuries, the girl who'd given him a green banana earlier in the day, balancing a basket of bones instead on her head, clicking her fingers, crisis photo tearing through the roots of the truck, his face covered with a soiled handkerchief, Mama Carlos screaming into the petrol can, the candle flame growing into a blue-tongued carcass in the bush, and the lines of the night reduced into the shape of a howl beneath tires crunching on stones.
Thank you so much. That was, it's so good to hear it read out loud. It's such a treat.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
That was wonderful. That was wonderful. I just see that, I was like, oh, this is such a privilege that we get to do this. It's a job we made ourselves, but oh my God, it's a great privilege to listen to stuff like that. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's so nice for me as a writer because, you know, it gives the story, I think, a different dimension to read it out loud. You hear things in it that, you know, maybe people miss on the page, actually. So that's quite a good thing to be able to read it out for an audience.
Yeah, you definitely do. There's as a reader, there's always emphasis or tone that you might interpret in your own head in a different way. For hearing it out loud, it's like, oh wow, yeah, okay, this is how it's meant to be read. This is yeah, it's great. Your collection, Nudibranch, has been described as extraordinary, surreal, experimental, and it kind of blew my mind with its ideas many times. Your stories are kind of reminders that anything can happen and life is exciting. Would you mind describing the collection for our listeners in your own words?
Thank you so much. That's very generous of you to say that. Yeah, I mean, not dissimilar to what you've just said. I feel like they are modern day fables, experimental modern day fables, about characters often at the cusp of some sort of change or transition. And transformation is something that I'm really interested in. You've read the collection, so you've probably picked up on this, you know, and how we process the difficult things in our lives as human beings, you know, trauma, loss, the psychological toll of death or really painful things, and what that can look like, but also what that can feel like carried in the body. And I'm really interested in unpicking all of that, especially especially about women characters, female characters, and particularly about Black women, because I feel like, you know, so much of our lives is still hidden. So on the page, I get to have the freedom to really explore subject matters and characters that I think are interesting, and that I think crosses a gamut of experiences. So I love the short form, and I feel like I should also say that I love the novel form too, to be fair. But there's something about the short form. When I first started writing short stories, actually, I picked up Dennis Johnson's Jesus's Son. That was the first short story collection I read. And that collection absolutely changed me as a writer. It blew my mind. I was so just taken by how freewheeling the collection was, but also the fact that it's essentially about a drug addict on the fringes, this collection, and it's intercollected stories about this character, and it kind of takes you through his world. But what it did so wonderfully was it allowed you to have empathy for him, to not judge him. And I thought that was so, so brilliant. And I thought, God, wow, I would love to be able to do something like this, you know, with short stories too. So that really kind of put a fire under me in terms of wanting to play with the form. But at my core, I think I want to shine a light on what's hidden and you know, people that are often on the fringes and kind of center them, but do it in ways that are unexpected. Because I feel like, you know, people expect certain things from Black writers and Black voices. And I kind of want to just push the boundaries with that and really be subversive in terms of just ideas, you know, the characters and the worlds that I create. So that was a really long answer to that question, but hopefully you get a sense of, yeah.
It was a great answer. You've actually covered a lot of our other questions already.
Oh, right. It's classic.
Yeah. It's great to hear you're also a Dennis Johnson fan. That collection is amazing, isn't it?
It's still my favorite short story collection ever. And I've read loads, but that one is so special. And it's very short as well. It's not a large collection, but yeah, it changed my my kind of approach to fiction, I think. I already knew that I was leaning towards the experimental, but there was something in that collection that it felt like there was permission in it as well. And similarly with Jamaica Kinsid, I should say. I don't know if you're familiar with her at all, but she's a brilliant Caribbean writer, also really subversive and very, very experimental. In fact, her short stories feel like paintings, and that really intrigued me. So yeah, these two writers, I think, had a real influence in terms of how I approached the form. Yeah.
I think it's apparent in your writing that it feels like when you write, there's no boundary at all to what could possibly happen on a story level, but also in a paragraph and even a sentence level. It's hard to predict. When you begin writing a story, do you know how it's going to end or what happens in the middle even?
That's such a good question. Often I know how it's going to end, but I don't know what's going to happen in the middle. So, and I like to start off with a really strong opening. And usually, you know, I have an image that stays with me that I want to kind of unpick. And I thought, God, this would be a really interesting premise to develop. So for me, I like the sense of unpredictability because it keeps things interesting. And, you know, I'm just as unaware as the reader in some ways, because, you know, things are coming to me as I'm writing the story. I'm not somebody that's very, very, you know, set on structure necessarily when I'm working on the first draft. I just want to have fun on the page. And I think that if I was to think about looking at the short story in a very, very structural way, I would be intimidated. Do you understand what I'm saying? So I often just approach that first draft as, this is just a space to play. This is just a space to kind of, you know, explore this idea and see what happens and see, you know, where these characters take you and where this world takes you. But no, I love the denseness that I can create, you know, within the short form. I love language so, so much. And I think that you know, when when something sits in between spaces, when writing sits in between spaces, that really interests me. Like, you can't quite fully define it, but there's this strange liminal space that can emerge, and that's very, very exciting. So that's how I try to approach it. And then, you know, second and third drafts, we try and get it into some sort of shape that feels like, oh, there's a beginning, middle, and end here. You know? But I think initially it's just the joy of just creating that world.
In Cornutopia, is it Cornutopia? Is that pronounced?
Cornutopia. Yeah,
which is brutal, absolutely brutal. I did not expect that. But you write in that the character writes, I was always the kid or teenager who befriended outsiders because they felt like my tribe. And it feels like this book is like you're collecting your tribe together. It really does feel like that. And all these different liminal characters come together. And your liminal characters are so good as well. They're so interesting. What's the process of you go into creating these characters? Do you write lots of backstory for them first, or is it just seeing what happens?
Thank you so much. A little bit of backstory sometimes with some of them. And then some of them, it's just, I have such a strong image of what they look like or my idea of them. And that, I think, once I get that on the page, then there's some momentum in terms of, okay, what sort of arc do I want them to have? You know, I've got to show vulnerability. I've got to show strength. I don't want them to, you know, they need to be fully rounded characters, and they have to go through some sort of, it sounds cliche, but definitely a journey that, you know, you take the reader along with you. And most of all, I really want the readers to care about my characters, you know, to really like have empathy for them and say, okay, I don't necessarily always agree with them, but I have empathy for them and this world that they're in. I remember I did a Zoom event after my story, Grace Jones, won the Kane Prize. And the woman that I did the Zoom event with, she said, you know, Renison, I know this story is really good and it won, but I have to tell you that, you know, I don't know if I like this main protagonist. I'm not sure I like her. And that was really interesting to me, because it was a woman, you know, moderating the conversation. And what I took from that was that she found this Black female protagonist quite complex, you know, and it wasn't necessarily the sort of protagonist that she's used to encountering, I think, for stories about Black women. So there was a little bit of push and pull there, you know, because the character's, you know, overtly sexual, she's traumatized, she's reenacting her trauma in very dangerous ways. So there's a lot there to kind of, I guess, push back against, but there's also a lot there to have some sympathy for. So it's really, really interesting. I never know how people are going to respond to the characters. I just hope that because I'm fascinated by the psychology of them, you know, that God, what happens when you put somebody like this in a high stakes situation? What happens when you put somebody like this who's carrying this guilt and weight of essentially feeling like, you know, they caused their family's death in this fire, this tragedy, and they, you know, they're punishing themselves for it. You know, what happens when you up the stakes for a character like that? So, yeah, for me, I love characters. I love sort of building them through the story. It's really a fun process. So I always approach my characters from a place of love and understanding. I don't judge them. I try to approach it from a place where I'm not, you know, being judgmental. Because like you said, you know, they often brutal things happen to them, and often they themselves can do brutal things, you know, and this is the world that we live in. And I don't want to shy away from that. I'm particularly keen on messy female characters. Because I think there is this societal expectation that women are supposed to contain themselves in particular ways, you know, contain your anger, contain things that are unjust, you know, behave properly. Well, sometimes you don't want to do that. Sometimes you just rage and you want to act out and you want people to suffer for what they've put you through. And, you know, all of that is like a cocktail for a possible disaster. But there's also something about the human experience in that I'm interested in. You know, so yeah, there's lots there, I think.
The BOB podcast is brought to you by Brick Lane Bookshop. As a thank you for listening to us talk about short stories, we're offering all listeners a 10% discount. Just use the code BLBPOD, that's BLBPOD, for a 10% discount of any purchase at bricklanebookshop.org.
So you talked about empathy, that you approach your characters with love. Because I've always had this problem with my characters, is that people read my stories and they're like, I don't like your character, and I can't chill with them at all. What approach do you do then when you're to make sure that the reader does feel empathy for your characters? Is it just sort of approaching them with love? Is that what you do?
I mean, essentially, I think the main thing is I try not to worry what the readers will make of them, because if I did, then I would feel compelled to maybe change things, or maybe this character would be more safe. Maybe if I didn't put them in this situation, or maybe if they don't react that way, they'll be more palatable. But actually, no, I want the freedom of being able to explore characters, from all different angles. And yeah, like I said, I think approaching them with real empathy helps. You know, what would make me understand being in a particular situation or have empathy for somebody who perhaps on the surface, you know, somebody might say that's not a nice person. That's not somebody I would want to like spend my time with. But you know, why are they behaving in the way that they're doing? You know, what's at the core of that? Let's look at that. Let's go back. Let's look at what might have caused that. Let's look at how they're coping, you know, and let's look at who's in their world. You know, are they somebody that is supported, or are they somebody that's, you know, they're completely spiraling because they don't have that support? Mental health, I should say, is also something I'm really passionate about and interested in. And I think that's clear in the stories too, that's something that I care about, because we all go through it. So it's important to kind of, yeah, shine a light on that subject matter as well.
Yeah. Another sort of preoccupation in the stories seems to be bodily detail and body parts. There's all these like really vivid descriptions. There's like lungs hanging from branches, and there's a description at one point of chicken skin layered over a body. And you mentioned the Hunterian Museum, which I've been to, and it made me feel a bit ill, but I loved it. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the importance of writing the body in your work.
Yeah, I really enjoy it. I think there's just a power to it. Like I said earlier, there's something about what we carry in the body, whether it's memory or trauma, that is really fascinating to see how that, you know, how that unravels. And I really like writing robust bodily experiences, and I guess quite dark bodily experiences too, you know, because we go through all that. The human body is fascinating, it's beautiful, it's strange, it's weird, it's all of these things. So why not explore that? There's a story called Kookaburra Sweet in the collection where the character becomes licorice, and she literally comes apart in that story. And I had such fun writing that. Yeah, I really enjoy, I think once the reader is invested in the world, and I say, you know, this is the world that you're in, I really enjoy pushing it and really, you know, stretching the boundaries of where the imagination can go. And I feel like there's so much in the body that allows you to do that as well.
Yeah, it certainly comes across. It's like, I remember kind of reading that one in particular and going, is she really going to go there? She's going to go there. Okay. Yeah. Amazing. This is so, it kind of, I felt my brain being slightly gradually kind of warped as I read. It's quite an enjoyable experience. A question linked to that one is how much sex there is in this book. Like, a lot of the stories are fueled by passionate desire, and characters devour each other sexually, but also literally sometimes. I wondered if you could talk about that and the importance of it.
Yeah, desire is such an interesting theme to me. Female desire, particularly, and again, Black female desire. You know, we don't see that depicted very often at all. So, It's a subject matter that I'm really interested in. I love to explore human appetites, and that is one of them. And there's such power in it as well, you know, being able to describe two people coming together in a way that they almost want to consume each other. I think I do that with one or two stories. And again, yeah, there's so much. I think there's a lot of restraints, especially in literary fiction, I think, around writing about sex. The wonderful Leonie Ross, I don't know if you're familiar with her. She's amazing and somebody who's inspired me a great deal as well. She writes sex, I mean, just, and desire, just incredibly. And I love what she does. And her work is considered literary fiction. So there's a boldness there, I think, as well. There's a sense of, for me, liberation in being able to like explore that. Because like I said, that there seems to be some sort of boundary around, you know, what you can or can't write about. And how women are depicted and how they carry desire. I want to explore it in a way where there isn't shame about it. You know, it's part of who we all are, and we all enjoy it. So why not write about it?
I think I read a Leonie Ross short story recently, and it's really kind of boldly sexual. And I think her writing and yours and several others, it's like you're kind of giving permission for other writers to just go there.
That's so good to hear. Because, yeah, when you're doing it, you just don't know how people are going to respond to it, you know, whether people are going to look down on it, because that's an element that, you know, you're passionate about. But at the end of the day, I think you just have to be authentic and be true to yourself as a writer, and just, you know, write about subjects that you're, and themes that you're passionate about. And that's one of them. I'm really, you know, keen to keep doing that, to see how, you know, how desire changes and how it can warp us and mutate. You know, the novel that I'm working on now, that is also a theme that I'm exploring as well, like female sexual desire. It's a strong theme within that, and just desire generally too. Yeah.
So we usually leave this question for further in the podcast, but as you've brought it up, what are you working on at the moment? What is the novel? Because I'm very excited. That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so the novel is a book about shamanism, you know, set in modern times, but also there's a you know, an ancient world as well, and there's a kind of familial legacy around that. But it allows me to do all the things that I'm excited to write about. It's strange and experimental, and there's a really strong female voice in it, I feel. So yeah, I'm pushing myself once again. You know, I want each book to feel different. I think my first novel, Butterfly Fish, that was, when I look back on that, I was a little bit crazy, to be honest, because I don't know how I had the gumption to try to attempt that, you know, writing three different timelines. I don't even know if I pulled that off successfully, but I was so passionate, you know, I was just so obsessed with creating those worlds that's what propelled me through it. And then, you know, with Speak Gigantula, that was just such a raw collection. And really, I was writing that through my like mid to late 20s. And that, it just allowed me to be able to explore, you know, being a young Black woman in ways that I thought were really subversive and exciting. And then Nudibranch, I just really went for it. I just didn't care. I mean, you can tell in that collection, I just really went for it. So This will be my second novel, which second novel syndrome is a thing, by the way. Some people say it's not a thing, but it is terrifying to be working on another novel again. But I'm excited, and that's, you know, with a novel, you sit with it for a long time. So it has to be, you know, something that you really care about, and something that, you know, ideas that you feel, you know, mean something, because you're going to be living with these characters obsessively for quite a while. You know, unfortunately, I had to stop working on it when the pandemic happened, because I got really ill, and it was really, really difficult to sort of focus on it, or focus on anything really. So much of the world that we recognize had changed. But it was really nice recently to be able to finally complete a draft of it at last. So now I'm in the stage where I've had a bit of a break from it, and then come October, I'm going to go into second draft stage with it. But yeah, no, I'm just I'm just excited to still have the desire to write, I think, because yeah, it can be, as you both know, you know, when you're writing, you're just sort of writing in the dark. You have no idea what's going to happen, or if anyone's going to take to the work. So it's really lovely to be in this space again. Yeah.
I'm in that dry period at the moment. I had a son during the pandemic, and because
of
the pandemic,
congratulations.
The son, thank you.
But that's lovely.
Jared McGuinness, who we had on the podcast before, is a friend of the bookshop. He was like, Peter, you won't write for 2 years. And I was like, I will, I'll keep up writing. I haven't written anything for 2 years. But it's you're right. It's just that I think a lot of people just lost the ability to like speak. Like we had a flow. Yeah. We all had a flow, and that got completely destroyed. And now we're in, got to pick up that flow again, but in a different way. But yeah.
I think some people, well, firstly, amazing that, you know, you're a father, and that is a, you know, that's a wonderful, wonderful thing, and no bad thing that's taken up so much time. And I'm sure you will be writing again soon enough. I mean, there were people I came across who were very productive during the pandemic, and I was like, who are these people? What's wrong with them? Yeah. How are they able to do this? I literally, like you said, you know, it was difficult to function. Like we were all in such shock about what was happening. So yeah, it's taken a while to be, you know, back in this space again. But yeah, it's a good thing.
Yeah, that is. I'm glad you're writing again, for sure. One of my questions actually is about your writing habits. How'd you go about it? I read or heard you say once that you read poetry to get your mind in a good state. Is that still the case, or have you got any other tips?
Yeah, when I first started writing, having that structure and that developing a discipline, I was reading poetry every morning. I was obsessed with a poet called June Jordan. I mean, I also credit her as somebody who really gave me permission to write as well, like such a brilliant Black American poet, like virtuosic in style and political charged work. So I was reading her stuff and I was just really, really impressed by what she was, you know, that you could do so much with that form as well, similar to the short story. So that kind of really encouraged me, and also allowed me to be able to play with language. And through that, I started writing my own strange little poems. Not that I show anybody these, but I sort of started writing maybe, you know, 8 to 9 poems, like mini poems a day, sort of in the morning, just to get me into that lovely headspace. And then I would write. I would work on whatever it was that, you know, I was interested in. But essentially, my writing habit is, when I'm working on a project, is waking up very early in the morning, so about 6:30 a.m., 7-ish, and then sort of writing in that sleep-wake state, because I feel like it really lends itself very well to the kind of writing I like to do. So kind of knowing when my optimum time of writing, figuring it out, that was very, very helpful for me. When I was working full-time, you know, I would try writing when I got back from work, and I was just too tired. Like in the evenings, I couldn't really do it. So it was like, right, okay, you have to get some writing in before you go in. And I should say, I mean, I'm a freelancer now, but during that time I was working for an organization called Apples and Snakes, which is a performance poetry organization. Great organization. And I was very lucky to be the national development coordinator there. First, I started off as their marketing person, but then transitioned into that, which was essentially finding exciting new talent all around the country. You know, so a bit like an A&R person, going to like seek exciting voices and then, you know, bringing them in to help develop. So I was in a privileged position, I think, in the sense that, you know, I was in this world where I was surrounded by poets, writers, producers, illustrators, just like highly creative people. And that was also encouraging, because it just meant that you were in this, and I was writing, but not really telling anybody that I was writing. I was just sort of doing it, as you do. But, you know, you get all this kind of fed in, I think, and it just helped a lot. So that was how, and during that period, I developed that, you know, that writing practice of, you know, waking up really early, being excited to just see what would come out of my head, writing it down. Also being scared if I didn't, you know, there was that thing, if I didn't write it down, I would like lose it. So I think fear kind of propelled me through creating my work, because I was just like, oh, I feel like I'm developing some sort of a voice. I don't know what's going to happen with it, but I need to keep practicing. You know, on a very sort of fundamental level, it was that. It's like, just keep going with it and see what happens, you know. So that was how my writing habits developed. But I think my tip is, yeah, know when your best writing time is. You have to figure that out, you know, try and see what works best for you. The other thing is, you know, I often will write in the morning and then go for a walk. I think lots of great ideas come when you go for walks. I have a dog, so you know, when we're keeping each other company, it's a good time to problem solve stuff in a piece of work, and also a good time for, you know, to get more ideas. I love going to galleries. I love galleries because I just feel so nourished when I see art, and really interesting art as well. So that's often a cool thing, and fringe theatre too. So just other mediums, soaking up other mediums that, you know, make you feel excited to want to create stuff, I think is also quite helpful, because through that, you know, you'll have ideas and you know, you'll develop, okay, strategies for how do I execute them? I have this idea. How do I make it happen? Who do I need to talk to? How do I develop a writing practice? How do I sustain that writing practice? Because when you work on a novel, you have to, like I said earlier, keep that momentum going. And one of the ways I do that is, if I just wrote all the time, I would go nuts, you know, if I just shut myself away. So I kind of have to do other things to feed in and keep that injection of, you know, excitement in there. Yeah,
it's so interesting you talked about the galleries that you go to. Me and Kate were talking about your book, and we were trying to describe what it was like, and I said it did feel like I was walking into a modern art museum, and there's some bits that you understand, other bits that just leave you in sort of awe, some bits of fear. It really feels like you're moving through like a space like that, where you're just like, all these new ideas are coming. So yeah, I thought it was just very interesting. But
oh, thank you, that's so great. I feel so happy that you said that, because literally I do that. That's literally what I do.
That's amazing.
Go to galleries and, you know, just, and write. So it's a mixture of different things that feed in.
You know that feeling when you go to a gallery and you, some bits that they speak to you and you understand them, and then some bits it's more emotional than anything else. You can't understand what's happening, but yeah, that's just what it felt like.
I know exactly what you mean, and you don't necessarily quite have the language as well to articulate what's happening, but you feel it. You feel yourself responding physically on some level. Yeah,
which is fascinating, because you are using language, but I think you use it in such an interesting way. You know, there's some bits that are more sort of normal prose, I guess.
I know what you mean.
But you know what I mean. And then the bits where you're just like, you're taking, I don't even like adverbs, and then doing crazy stuff with them, and making, it's an experience. It really is an amazing experience to read your work. It's incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. You know, some days I feel like I can't string a sentence together. Today is one of those days, and you just lifted my my spirits with that.
That's good.
Yeah.
Okay, just to pivot slightly, rather than just the language, your stories are also set over, you know, all over the world and all over time as well. You know, Berlin, Mozambique, English countryside, dystopian future, Japan, Elephant and Castle, also Japan, Prussia, 18. What draws you to do this?
Well, because they're interesting. They're interesting to me. They're places either I've been to, or I imagine myself in another life, perhaps having experienced or lived in, and writing about it is a way of making that happen. You know, obviously I never lived in 18th century Prussia, but I was like fascinated by what that would be like. And I love the circus. Like, there's just so many interesting stories within that space. So it felt like, yeah, it felt great to be able to set a circus story in that world, you know. And similarly, I guess, you know, I wrote about Cape Verde as well in my first collection, Speak Gargantua, but I actually went there. And that was how that piece came about, because I was just interested in traveling to other parts of Africa. I'm from Nigeria. I was born in Nigeria, moved to the UK when I was 8. So I have this, I think, duality in terms of identity. And it's interesting because it's always slightly shifting. You know, when I'm in Africa, they can blatantly tell that, you know, I'm from the West. They're like, who are you trying to kid, you know, with your accent and, you know, the obvious signs. And then when I'm in the UK, I'm Black British, but I'm also other as well, you know. So it's interesting being able to explore all of that. And I had such an emotional experience in Cape Verde. Like, so much happened. This was in my 20s, you know. I had a holiday fling that was great. My sister and I were there together. We fell out spectacularly. You know, I made new friends. Like, so many things happened. And I was able to write about it because that was my way of processing the experience, you know. So I'm just really interested in the human experience. And I love the idea that there is, like, the world is this palette that you can, this huge palette that you can play with and have different colors and textures and voices. And, you know, what does that look like? How do you make a world with that? So yeah, it's just the curiosity at its core. And why just limit myself? You know, why only just limit myself to what I know? Okay, yes, write what you know, absolutely. But also, it's fun to write what you don't know, because in the not knowing, you know. You know, so I wrote about monks for one of my stories in Nudibranch. And the interesting thing is, I was living in Barking at the time, and there was the ruins of this old monastery that I would pass every day. And I'm so curious about monks, just that their hidden lives and the way that they live that we don't really know. And I've always thought, oh, wouldn't it be great to write a story about them? But I was so terrified, because I thought, who am I to try to attempt this, you know? But when the opportunity came to write about it, it felt like the perfect story at the time, because I thought, A, I'm intrigued by it, and B, the notion of silence in this world, which turned out to be quite a violent world, actually, really fascinated me, like the cost of silence, how bodies react when they have to carry silence, you know, the extremes of silence. So that was really, really interesting to me. So I think there's something in being able to test yourself as a writer in that way, where you're kind of wading into the unknown, you know. I think as long as you do it, you know, with a sense of, I guess, respect as well, that's important. That's that, like, you should be able to write about anything, but come at it from a place of genuine curiosity and with some respect. And then I think, you know, you can, the reader can sense that, you know, once they're invested in that world, they know. So yeah, I just, my curiosity, my excitement, my, like, desire to get into the heads of how other people live and the different worlds that I don't know, as a storyteller, I want to know, you know. So that's what gives me permission. It's not even that I, like, have a certain confidence in doing it. It's just the sheer joy of going, oh my God, I had this idea. I wanted to see what it looks like on the page. How am I going to do that? And then when I get to the end of that, I'm like, oh my God, literally, it's something took over my brain. I don't know how this happened, but it's this kind of space that you go into, you know, that you're almost a transcendence, I feel, when you're just, you know, you're so caught up in creating these different stories and worlds, and, you know, in different countries. It's just, it's really, really fascinating. Yeah. That was another very long answer.
I like your long answers. The energy is infectious. You make me want to sit down and write my wildest ideas right down.
Oh, I love that. Yes, I'm doing something right.
I guess I wanted to ask about whether you have a visual mind. It feels like you must do, because the details are so vivid and they're sort of packed with imagery, your stories. Do you see them very vividly as you're writing them?
Yes, yes, definitely. In fact, often, you know, the images can be the catalysts for a story, you know. So in Speak Like Angela, there's a story about, you know, a woman who finds a tiny man in her garden and she takes him, holds him hostage and begins to like have this very dark relationship with him. And that came to me as a very strong image at first. And I remember that it just wouldn't leave me that whole day. And I thought, God, that's a really striking image. You know, so what's the story here? You know, how do I create context around this? You know, what's the beginning? What's the middle? How does it end? So yeah, images is huge for me. Image and language to be able to express that image in the right way. And also, I guess, maybe disconcerting the reader a bit too, taking them out of a sense of comfort. Not that there's anything wrong with having comfort when you read. You know, there are loads of books that I've read have given me comfort, and you know, there are writers that do that brilliantly. But I think often I want to challenge the reader too. So I try to make the images, you know, I try to push it with my imagery and you know, make them slightly subversive and try and make them images that the reader will remember or want to come back to and say, oh, hold on a minute. Is there like a double meaning in this, or like there's a third meaning in this image? I need to come back to it. And often it can be instinctive, you know, just as I'm writing it, you know, it will come to me. So yeah, I definitely think that's something that's very important to me while I'm writing.
One interesting thing I wanted to ask you. So you've sat on many short story prize competition judging panels, I think that's correct, including short story prize and Maslexia and all sorts of stuff. What are you looking for in a short story? When do you know you found a good one?
I think usually I'm looking for an authentic voice. Just there's a certain confidence there, and just, yeah, characters I care about and a world that I want to stay in. Because, you know, with short stories, there are so many out there that to really hold the reader's attention, I think they have to be quite striking. So I'm looking for a striking voice, and I'm looking to maybe learn something new about, you know, a world that I don't really maybe not know a lot about. That's often a very exciting for me. But yeah, so if they're pushing the boundaries as well, then I'm even more excited. I'm that judge on the panel that fights for experimental stuff, you know, because often those stories divide a panel. You know, you will have half the judges hate it and the other half will love it, you know, and I'm usually on on the side that really I have a real appreciation for that, obviously, because of the sort of writing that I do. But generally, you know, just a very, very well written story that stays with you. I'm looking for something that stays with you, you know, that you read it and you go, oh my God, that character was amazing. You know, I had an emotional response. It's what we were saying earlier. I had an emotional response to this piece, or something about, there's just something in the voice that's really distinctive. So these are the things that I look out for, as well as it just being, you know, you've seen the craft in it. You know, you want it to be well executed. Sometimes you have, you know, the idea is really good, but it's not executed well enough, but you can see that there's potential there. And it's quite nice to be able to discover those voices as well. And I think that's the wonderful thing about, it's such a privilege sitting on these competitions, because man, there are so many talented writers out there. I mean, it's just mind-blowing and really invigorating as well. So, you know, when you're able to like shortlist or longlist voices like this, you know that it's an encouraging thing, and it just gives people that extra confidence. So partly I really love that aspect too, you know, that we're going to find, you know, even if they're not fully there yet, we're going to find voices that are exciting, or, you know, that are doing things that are really, really interesting. And, you know, often for a short list and a long list, I guess we're looking for a mix. We want different types of stories, you know, different types of perspectives and voices, not just the same thing, which is why you have a panel. You know, otherwise if it were just me, it might just be one thing or another judge. So it's a really wonderful experience. I keep getting asked to do them, and I find it hard to say no. That's the thing. You know, no, it's a lovely thing.
For your work through these panels, and of course for Apples and Snakes, is there anybody, any writers that you're particularly proud to have discovered, or proud the right word, or excited to have discovered?
I mean, so many. When I was in Apples and Snakes, there was a wonderful poet called Zena Edwards, who was just brilliant. I mean, she was mixing spoken word and song, and it was almost sort of griot style, like storytelling, that was very, very compelling. So I really enjoyed her. Kate Tempest, I don't know if you're familiar with Kate. So when I worked at Apples and Snakes, fantastic poet. Lem Sisse, also huge poet, just a very dynamic, you know, very, very compelling to watch, like his physicality on the stage, and his story is so interesting as well, like his backstory, but his writing is really, really excellent. So yeah, there are many. You know, I could go on, but yeah, I feel like I was really lucky to kind of be in that space where you're discovering these very, very exciting voices. And again, it's like, you know, they kind of give you permission to keep doing the work that you're doing. So yeah, that was fun.
Our final question is one we ask everyone, which is, what are you reading now? And are there books or particular writers that you always return to?
Yeah, I mean, okay. So I always will return to Toni Morrison, Margaret Atwood, Asela K. Le Guin. These are giants to me, who just women doing incredible things on the page. And I just get like just such permission from what they do. You know, every time I feel that fear, I will go back and read their books, or Jamaica Kinsid as well, and just think, oh, okay, there is a space for me. You know, when I felt like there wasn't, those women made me feel like you can create. If there isn't a space, you can create the space. So that's what I take from them and continue to take from them. At the moment, I'm reading, and I got given this actually at the residency that I was in. I'm reading a book called, who'd be pleased to know, called Anonymous Sex. It's an anthology edited by Cheryl Lou Lien Tan, who is a wonderful woman and writer, and was at the Barcelona residency that I was at recently. And she edited this book, and it's got stories by Louise Eldridge, Tierra Britt, Helena Yeomi, Jason Reynolds, and lots of other wonderful writers. The only thing is, you don't know who wrote what. And it's just, yeah, they're really cracking stories about sex and relationships and, you know, encounters. So yeah, that's a fun read at the moment.
That's a good recommendation. I have to find that one. I was just going to say thank you very much for making time to talk to us, Irina Sinekoje. It's been such a pleasure to hear how you think about your work.
Thank you so much for having me. I could talk to you guys for an extra 3 hours, but I know you have lives and other things to do, so I don't want to hold you hostage. As you can tell from my very long answers, that
we can have you back on again when you get your next novel comes out. I think that'd be really good. Let's definitely do that.
Oh, that'd be wonderful. Yeah, let's definitely make that happen. Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this chat.
Yeah, us too. Thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the B&B podcast. Please remember to rate and review us. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. You can get in touch on social media via @BrickLaneBooks or email us at inquiries@BrickLaneBookshop.org. The music, as ever, is by Andrew Everett. Andrew is also a bookseller at Brick Lane Bookshop, and we'd like to thank him for allowing us to use a section of his beautiful track, Can't Have Everything, for the show. If you like his music as much as we do, you can find more on andreweverett.bandcamp.com. This is the final episode of season 1, but we'll be back with more later in the autumn. Thank you for listening.